Welcome to the Unfiltered Podcast with me, Joe Warner, and powered by Ultimate Performance, the world's premier personal training experience that delivers maximum results in minimum time. In each episode of the Unfiltered Podcast, I interview the most respected, celebrated, and controversial experts in the fields of health, fitness, nutrition, well-being, and performance to help you find the life-changing advice you need to live smarter. Remember, you can find all of our exclusive Unfiltered documentaries, video interviews, and investigations at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. And now, on with the show.
So, Michael, it's great to talk to you today. I was hoping we could begin with you giving me a little bit of an overview about Svexa and what you do, and then we can get into some more deep questions.
Yeah, of course. Let's jump back and forth with the questions there as well. So Svexa is a intelligence company. The intelligence layer is kind of the easiest way to explain it. So trying to calculate what's optimal for each individual in each situation. It's the super short explanation.
And what was the inception? Where was the origin of this idea? And when did you have it? And how has it kind of led to where we are today?
So we're group of researchers to begin with. So we were, I shouldn't say reluctant entrepreneurs, but there was never the plan. We started getting from a precision medicine perspective. We had work in medicine and genetics and biomedical data sciences, and then physiology as well. So we happened to be in a good position when all the big tech companies wanted into that industry, and being here in Silicon Valley, we were positioned in the right place.
And what were the main challenges of getting the company off the ground? Because obviously where we are, it's a huge area. Health and wellness is such a growing industry. But I imagine there were still some pretty big challenges to get things started. Could you talk me through some of what the biggest ones were?
Yeah, getting started, we decided to do a bootstrap version from the beginning. So we were asked by pro sports teams. It was actually the football clubs, the soccer clubs, if we're here in England and Italy, that reached out to us as researchers. And they said, can you do anything with our data? So before we were Svexa, we had done that and kind of calculated in your risk assessment and stuff like that. So we realized this niche, being a B2B company, providing the algorithms, providing the calculations, that niche with the group of people we have, we can be really successful. And it's not very common to have the combination of practical knowledge, so experience in the sports industry or health industry, and the scientific level, and also the sports side and the data side. So now it's much more common, but this is when we started getting the questions, that's almost 10 years ago now. So we started Svexa 5 years ago. And back then we realized this is something that we can do. We can be really good at this. So we should start a company. So to start the company being here, that's not much of a challenge. And then you take it one step at a time. And obviously, challenge to prove that it works, have enough data to say that something is valid and works from even a scientific perspective. If we come at it not from a business perspective, trying to sell the hype, but rather from a scientific perspective, can this work? Is it going to help people? Is it good enough?
Right.
We didn't want to just try to sell something.
And 5 years down the line now, individualized health and fitness services, recommendations, products, they're kind of everywhere.
Yeah.
But in your experience or your expertise, are we where you thought we would be after 5 years? Are we ahead of the curve? Or are we behind the curve? What's your take?
We're fortunate. We feel fortunate that the things that we betted on would happen, did happen. So we're now where people are talking more about it compared to 5 or 10 years ago. It's nothing new, really. It's just that we can measure more things.
Okay.
We started developing algorithms for, it's the scalability thing, scalable individualization. So you would have your good coaches or personal trainers or whatever. They would have, if you worked with them, they would be able to tweak to you. Like a good coach in sports would talk to you every day and fine tune and see how you're reacting to different things. So that's always been the case. And you can pay for a good personal trainer to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you would have like World Health Organization recommendations, 300 minutes a week type thing. And how do we move the general recommendations towards the the personal trainer or pro coach.
Yeah.
And in terms of if we're behind or after the curve, if anything, we're going to see leaps forward in the upcoming years. Let's put it like that. And in terms of 15 years ago, when you tried to do individualization, we basically had heart rate monitors and stopwatches and a bit of, you know, barbells and weights and stuff. Uh-huh. But now you can measure everything. So monitoring is no longer a problem. And getting the data together is starting to not be a problem anymore. You have a lot of platforms that could take care of that. But then the next step is to, what does this mean for me as an individual? And what should I do about it? And we're not there yet. I would say that almost all the gadgets that you can buy now display the data. And the level of insights will be, you are here.
Okay.
You sleep 8.2 hours per night on average. And it was less or more or less than you did last month. But what does that mean? And what should I do to change it? And what is it connected to? What does it matter? Does it matter if I sleep 7 or 8? Is something improving? Yeah.
So we're at the point now where maybe everything is a little bit maybe in isolation. You've got the data, but you might not know what to do with it, how to improve it, what it really means.
Yeah.
Is that something we're going to see some pretty seismic developments over the next 5 to 10 years as things become more connected and coordinated?
I certainly hope so. That's one of the core things in Svexa's offering, that we're able to take it to the next level. That's why the intelligence layer, what do I do with this? And then also sorting what is most important for me. So if you have different gadgets, you measure all the things, you would have thousands of correlations. So you can't handle all thousands of those at the same time, right? So you want to take care of the things that are most important for you. And that might be something, what's most important for you might be different than what's most important for me. And that will change to next month. And also, how do you make that without it being an effort for people? So it must be ambient. It must happen in the background. So that's why battery life is a big thing. If your watch or your ring can last for a month, that would be way better because you would have the data all the time. You don't have to think about it just happening. If it is adjusting to you. So at Svexa, we're working with training planning system. So up until now, if you got a training plan from a running training plan from a coach, you could get 12 or 16 weeks and you got your plan and it was tailored to you in terms of where you are, how many days a week you wanted to train. But it didn't adapt to how you responded to the training. It didn't adapt to if you missed a Tuesday because you had to pick up the kids or whatever. And that is doable nowadays. So you can have the tweaks in real time and you can get the recommendations adjusted to your situation now. Not the optimal, but where we are.
But it's certainly getting closer to being optimal. In terms of the next big breakthrough in this space, is it going to be led by technology? Is it going to be led by software? Is it going to be led by algorithms? Where is it going to be if we can identify one area that's going to be ultimately responsible for getting us closer to where you think the market could be?
I'm thinking in the translation aspect.
Okay.
So you would have the hardware technologies, you would have the software, you would have the analytics and AIs. But what does it mean and how do you connect them? What is accurate with the hardware? What can you change? The generative AI solutions, where can they help and where can't they help? You've heard a lot now about the generative AI and that they can be confidently wrong, right? Which is because it's probabilistic. What's the most reasonable words to come after this? And I think that understanding and translating between the different silos and understanding what's needed between different disciplines, different areas, is what's needed next.
And what is the key to bridging that gap between this wealth of information and analytics, and the average user who may not be very experienced in translating or even understanding what it means. It sounds small when you say it, but obviously that's a big, big gap that needs to be bridged. Where is the solution to that problem, and how big a problem is it?
I would say it's a huge problem. It's like you could have the technology, but it needs to be easy to use as well. Mm-hmm. So the user interface is something completely different than the technology itself. And you would get leaps forward where people adopt to that. And in order to do that, you must think across the entire line. So from what you're measuring in this case to how it's received and what you can do with it. We're running, starting Stanford studies now, where we're thinking about motivational profiles. So you would have people that are keen to see the numbers in technology. You will have the early adopters that, mm-hmm. that would just love to see the number and it's fun for them.
Right.
But that's just a small portion of the population. So you would have another group of people, another style of people that would care much more about the emotional connection to it. Why should I do this? What does it matter? And you could think of the prompts for someone like that would be more around, you should do your training today because then you would have a better chance of playing with your grandchildren.
Yeah.
And then yet another group of people are social. So for them, it would be much more important not to see the number, but to make sure to schedule your training session together with your friend. Be accountable for that. And now we're coming into something that's completely different than the technology. The technology is there, but how do you take it all the way to people's behavioral change as well? And understanding what you can use in the technology to change people's behavior and therefore their health situation, or for athletes, their performance level.
And how far away are we from having a fully coherent offering that ticks all of your kind of to-do, your dream wish list scenario? Are we close? Are we getting closer? Are you optimistic it's just around the corner?
Oh, we're getting closer all the time. So we can start with the technology side of things. As I said, 15 years ago, you could only measure heart rate and stopwatch. And then we started getting more like GPS tracking and power meters and all of that so that you can measure more things during your training. And then more and more around off the field as well. So you could get the weather data into your training plan automatically. You could get your sleep tracking into there. Now you would have glucose monitors so you can see how your body is reacting to the nutrition. I think that the piece that's missing is an easy way to gather what you actually ate.
Okay.
That is still too cumbersome for people to do a food diary or...
Because what we need is take a picture of your meal and it tells you exactly the calories, the macro breakdown, right? Yeah. Because then you've got useful data
then that you
takes
have it,
out the human element.
So I think that we're starting to get that the sleep tracking is good enough and things are moving there, and you would have more and more biomarkers measured. So the next step will be to get glucose and not from a finger prick or from a device, but from light, so that you can get your hormones on and your glucose and other stuff from your watch. That's another breakthrough, because then you can have it 24/7 and all the hormones and changes and you can adjust to that. And then we just have the nutrition left, I would say.
Can you talk a little bit about Silicon Valley and launching a business here? Could you have launched Vector anywhere else in the world, for instance, or did it have to be here? And if so, why?
So first of all, you can start a business anywhere, right? And here it is, the ecosystem is pretty amazing. Not just pretty amazing, it is amazing. that you would have a lot of people with experience from starting successful companies. A lot of experience from starting non-successful companies as well, but a lot of experience. And you would have the funds, and you would have different levels of funds. You would have the ones that would go for you early with an idea stage, and you would have all the way up to the ones that would fund you forever type thing. And also the understanding that those are different. which I didn't have coming here. I didn't understand the different types of money that you could get depending on what you were interested in, and how you wanted to run your company would affect who you would ask for money. Mm-hmm. So that type of ingrained understanding of how to do it and what's successful, and also the diversity of ways to do it within a small ecosystem.
Okay.
That is pretty amazing. But comparing Sweden to Silicon Valley, you could start, you have a lot of unicorns, successful companies from Sweden as well, especially compared to how many people are in the country, which is a very, very different situation. Where it's more you have to fight your way through. But if you fight your way through that ecosystem, it's easier the rest of the world.
Okay.
Here, everyone is positive, and you would have a lot of move fast, break things, and fail quickly ideas, which make things go faster here.
Is that the difference, I guess, trying to find out what makes this part of the world unique in terms of the type of companies that you're running? Is it that in a lot of the world, if you fail, you're kind of, you're hunkered down, you go back to the drawing board, where here it seems as though you dust yourself up, you get back up, what's the next thing? Where's the innovation? What's our next idea? Is that true? Well,
definitely true. So it's way better here to start your third startup.
Okay.
It's easier to be funded for the third one than the first one.
Right.
Even if you fail the two first one, but the assumption is that you have the experience,
okay,
and that you wouldn't do the same mistakes again, and therefore it's more likely that you would succeed the third time.
So there is just that culture of failure, but it's not necessarily seen as how it might be in the UK or Sweden or other parts of the world.
Yes, yeah, so you would have that, and you would have a lot more visionary thinking. You would talk to the in the UK or in Sweden, you would have more of a build a business idea and kind of the progression.
Yeah.
Here, to a higher degree, you skip all of that. What's the end? What's the end goal?
Okay.
And you wouldn't be funded at the first level until you know that the market is big enough for the big idea.
Okay.
Which is interesting, kind of a difference in mindset.
An individual who wants to optimize their performance and use data more effectively, where we are now with the technology, what should they prioritize? What's the most important thing for them to focus on? And a follow-up to that, where are most people going wrong in terms of trying to analyze their data themselves?
So if we start with because most data is available around the training, that's the thing that most people look at the most.
Okay.
And then look at one thing in isolation from the other will be the second problem. Right? You might look at your training data, or you might look at your sleep tracking data and not put them together. Okay. So I think trusting one source and be overwhelmed by the amount of things that you can measure, I think that's the most common thing. It's too much, right? So you pick one. You go with your watch, or you go with your ring, and you go with, this is my training data, and I know where I'm going on my strength training or endurance or whatever it might be. I know if I'm going the right direction or if I broke my personal record or not. Or I go with my sleep tracking, and I can see that it's telling me that I'm good or bad or matching my numbers or not.
And with the individual as well, focusing on this just for a minute, I think there's a bit of a disconnect between sometimes what the data can tell you and how you're actually feeling, right? Because at the moment we've got a technology that will kind of give you the results or the ideal situation for the average person.
Yeah.
So for instance, I measure my sleep.
Yep.
Some mornings I'll wake up, feel great, check my watch and says, I've had an awful night's sleep.
Yeah.
And then I do feel more tired, even though I felt okay before the data.
Yeah.
What is your take, and how do we fix the individual issue here, in that take heart rate variability as well?
Yeah.
Not a big issue for some people, whereas for others it can be. Sleep, some people might not need as much. How do we take this general data or this generic data and suit it to an individual's needs and requirements so they can optimize their performance?
Yeah, the biggest problem to begin with is that all these companies, they have no outcome data, usually. So you don't know what happened. You don't know your performance level.
Okay.
You just have your sleep data, mm-hmm. you see here, but not what happened. So imagine if you did that for an athlete and you didn't measure the length of the jump or the height or whatever, and you didn't connect that to the training you had done. So that's the biggest problem.
Because that's the most important,
yeah.
the outcome, and that's yeah. the bit that we just don't have any tracking of.
Exactly, but that's going to be way better when you can combine it with different, okay. when you combine all of them. You would see that if you have your sleep tracking and then you also have your performance metrics from your running training session or your connected strength training, you see the numbers there and you can kind of reverse engineer how well you slept and what matters to you to do your progression, right? If you have enough data. So again, that's something that we do now with elite athletes, create their profiles and see what they respond well to and not, how they respond to travel, stress, or time zone differences, or going to altitude, going down from altitude, because they have their metrics.
Okay.
You should have a little bit, if you do a little bit more of this type of training, you improve better than this type of training. And it used to be the coaches that had to do that. And the good coaches, they would know that I can tweak this athlete to do more high intensity, but stay away from the volume and vice versa. But now we're in a situation we can start do that automatically with the data. Again, if we have enough data streams. So go back to the gadgets that you have now. If you have one type of measurement, there might be several types of data in there. So a sleep tracking might have heart rate variability, might have temperature, might have breathing rate and everything. But it's from one type of metric.
Okay.
So you have objective metrics, but not subjective. You have input data, but not output data. So if you can combine that, you kind of leap forward. And then also to adjust that to, the biggest problem is that the gadgets would use group average starting point numbers. So for example, and then use that as a proxy for when you fall asleep or not.
Okay.
So it might be, for example, take something easy. If you have a sleep tracking, they might have a cutoff and say, you're not asleep if you have heart rate of 100. Okay, and that's pretty reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you wouldn't put that limit at 100. You would put it as low as possible, right? So you would say, if you have a heart rate over 60, you're not asleep. But then some people will have their sleep heart rate over 60.
Mm-hmm.
So they will be categorized as awake all the time when they were asleep. And that's stressful.
Sure.
So just by small tweaks, it might have been, let's say that they were at 60 and then they, for some reason, they lowered their heart rate for 2 beats per minute and they were at 58. And then they're within the frame of the algorithm in the gadget. And therefore, everything was okay. back to normal. And a thing that it's not talked about a lot is that all of these metrics, if it's resting heart rate or heart rate variability or temperature, they're individual. So for body temperature, you would have 37, right? But that's group average. And some will have half a degree or a degree lower, and some will have half a degree higher, and that's your number. So you need to start from that. And same with heart rate variability. The your normal variation is not necessarily the same as my normal variation. And also the next layer of that is that some metrics matter to you and some metrics matter to me.
Okay.
So for me, for example, heart rate variability might be the perfect metric. And for you, it's useless. It doesn't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen the same thing in sports. If we look at injury risk assessment, you can see that a commonly used metric is high-speed running, amount of high-speed running. And it's a great metric on group average. So if you take the entire squad, the entire group, all the players, that's a good metric. And it's a great metric for some players. And it's a so-so metric for some players, and it's a useless metric for roughly a third. Okay. It's interesting. We come to the same conclusion almost all the time. That's one third of people is responding the opposite way of what you're supposed to.
And what's that down to? Just genetic differences?
Genetic differences and physiological profile.
Okay.
And it's nothing weird. We would see the same things in everything. You would see the variation if you train a group of people. Some will respond a lot. Some will respond in the middle, and some not at all. And it's pretty kind of linear, consistent in that, in all different types of metrics and all different types of responses.
But the movement from having these kind of these group averages to a truly individualized approach, it's simply a case of just making sure you're collecting the output data that can then be cycled back in, and then it becomes an entirely bespoke solution, right?
Exactly.
And how far away are we from the average person having access to that kind of, you know, you mentioned the sports teams you've worked with, you must be learning an incredible amount about how it works for elite athletes, but what about for the average Joe?
Yeah, so because it's you, so this is again something that is it's nice to be in Silicon Valley and be in the middle of everything that's happening. So you would talk, previously you talked a lot about big data, and the more data the better. And you can get to a certain degree of accuracy with big data. And if you think about the Google ad that's recommended for you, or doesn't really matter if that's super accurate or not. But if you can get to 80% accuracy, that's fine. It's way better than just guessing or sending the same ad to everyone. So you can get there with big data. But if you're thinking about yourself, if I'm thinking about me, 10,000 other people, data from 10,000 other people wouldn't help me. So you move away from big data to small data, and you focus on longitudinal data about you instead, right? So the researchers here at Stanford that started with it, I think the first example was around farming. So crop optimization in Africa. And then you could think of, well, we should gather all the data from all the farms in the country, in the area. Well, actually, it's not exactly the same, and the situation in this farm is not the same as that farm and not the same as that farm. So to optimize this farm, I should think about this farm only and the microclimate here, right? Okay. That was the original. And humans are exactly the same, right? So having more data about you is much more, much stronger, much more powerful in terms of calculations. Okay. And then you can be accurate about what's important for you. So then going back to the original question, how far away from normal people are we? So if you have your own data, as of now, I think that you need it over time. Mm-hmm. So most people are starting now. But when we start with a football team, a soccer team, they would already have 3 years of historical data on all the players. So you can kind of reverse engineer the profile. But if someone starts their plan now, if they buy a gadget or they go to a clinic that will help them, they need to collect their data first. But that is A, collecting the data, and B, understanding that you need to do that, not use the standard metrics.
Okay.
So from a kind of mental and idea perspective, we're already there. For general population, if you can collect the data, you're there. So it might be still a bit expensive to buy the gadgets and collect the data. So it's still people that are on the kind of quantified self and focused on their health. And here you have a lot of longevity. And so it's moved from elite athletes to a group where we're now recreational athletes would have kind of tried to optimize, and quantified self, longevity buffs. And it's not that far from the next step of having your data combined with your general physician or just having companies helping you figuring out what to do with your data. Okay. It could be the insurance companies. That's a bit tricky from an ethical perspective.
And that leads on to what I was hoping we could talk about in terms of using it for other areas outside of optimal performance and sporting performance, for instance. Yeah. If you go to see your GP because you're your doctor because you're not feeling well, they're basically going to ask you some questions. They're not going to drill you for any data. Yeah. And a lot of us have more and more data available that might be identifying heart rate variability, sleep, stress levels, all these other metrics. At the moment, there feels like there's an enormous disconnect between what we're gathering and what could be useful for diagnostic or other purposes.
Yeah.
I guess that leads on to ethical considerations around data insurance you've mentioned.
Yeah.
Where are we from that crossover to that the general population, general health, rather than just sporting performance in actually being able to use some of this data to help diagnose people maybe early when there might be a serious problem.
Yeah, so this is not a new question, right? It's perfectly logical that it would be cheaper for society, better for the individual to prevent rather than treat,
mm-hmm.
Okay? That's nothing new. Still didn't happen for many, many years. Now we're starting to get to a situation where you have the data and the data can flow to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
That's doable. So at Stanford, they got the Apple data coming into the medical records 6 years ago now. And meaning that then the doctor would see your activity levels, not have to ask you how active are you, because people either don't know or might exaggerate a little bit. So they would know that. And then you as a doctor having 20 minutes to assess someone, mm-hmm. Would be much easier to make a good decision if you had additional data streams. But then it's also a complete change in competence. Medical doctors are great at medical issues, which is basically pathology from disease to treat it, to okay. But not before that necessarily. That's not in their they can't expect it to do that because it's not in their education. So probably need a shift in who is doing that, who's taking care of that, who's helping. And you would have now a kind of group of doctors that are interested and therefore would do it. And that would be more of a private medical type thing.
And it's almost like you have a team of resource with people being able to spot potential issues ahead of time.
Yep.
But I mean, that's not something we're going to see in general healthcare, right? Or free at the point of access healthcare, because that sounds very expensive, right?
Yeah. So you're exactly right. That's where we are now. That if you can afford it, you would have the concierge medical situations where you have your entire team around you, and you would probably have your sleep coach there, and you would have your nutritionist, and you would be more or less pampered as an elite athlete, but you have to pay for it. And there are both here in the US and in Europe, there are large efforts into health data and handling health data and getting recommendations out of health data, so that part will be automatic, both to the primary care, and it might be to everyone directly to the individual. But then we come into, it must be digestible for the individual, must be easy enough and accurate enough for it to be actionable. And I think we're a few years, depending on how fast it is, and in medical it's usually not that fast. So probably a decade before that's something that's in general for the general population.
Is one of the biggest issues the general knowledge and understanding of the end user? Because you can make it, I guess, as simple or as actionable as possible, but we're still relying on the person getting the data through their phone or their device to maybe not necessarily interpret it, but at least action it. Is there an education piece that's needed around this to ensure that people are getting the most out of their devices, the technology, the products and the services?
Probably educational, but we can take the analogy with training. I think there, it's not educational problem in terms of people know that it's good for you to exercise.
That's
common knowledge. And to some degree, it would be educational and what should I do in each situation. But most people know what they could do. They know that they could go for a run or go to the gym. Or so that's not really the problem. It's the behavioral change and making the investment in time.
Okay.
And that the technology is ambient and seamlessly integrated in your life. So it's not a threshold to have to climb or get over to get there. So that threshold might be it's expensive to do it.
Mm-hmm.
The numbers, I don't trust the numbers. You would have historically, it's again, it's five, 6 years ago, you would have something like Fitbit got sued for $1 billion because people were upset that the numbers were not accurate and they overpromised or something. So I think it's more of a maturity of the technology and understanding the full chain. So from technology to how does it help me today? Not 10 years from now, How does it help me today?
Something that still circulates around, you know, fitness trackers or other kind of monitors. And I think the difference probably is between actually measuring something such as heart rate or your sleep, or then calculating. So we have steps or we have calories burned.
Yep.
I think a lot of people kind of just group all of the information into one whole without the distinction between the measurement and the calculation. How big of a problem is this in your view, and what are some of the options of solving that gap, bridging the gap between the calculation and the measurement?
We can take one step back and say that the maturity of what seems like all technologies, it seems to be like at first you can just give someone a number and that's cool, and you can sell by giving someone a number. If you could measure heart rate, no one knows what it means. You can just have heart rate, it works.
Yeah.
And then you would say, we can get a sleep number. And in the beginning, they were absolutely terrible. Mm-hmm. Or you could get an energy expenditure number and you get something. That's cool. You can measure it.
Because before you had nothing, right?
Exactly.
So it's an improvement.
Yeah. And then it will take kind of the first cycle will be, well, people will say, this is not correct. This doesn't make any sense. And then you need to be accurate. At least reasonably accurate. Mm-hmm. But then you're just displaying a number. You're displaying an accurate number, but no one knows what to do with that number. It's just a number. And then the full maturity would be, how does this fit with your situation? What can you do with this number, and what does it mean, and what's the action following this number? And all the gadgets we have now, so if we think about watches, a lot of them started in 2015. So you would have the first 2-3 years, you would have many, many different companies having watches. Microsoft and all of them had their own watches, Google. And you would have kind of in combination with Nike Fuel Band, that was a step counter at the same time. And then it took a few years. So 2017, 2018, you had kind of a drawback. And most of the companies skipped that.
Yeah.
And then now you've had, over the last couple of years, more and more accuracy and people going into medical grade for atrial fibrillation and stuff like that. And you have more and more metrics. So in every new version of the watch update, you would have more metrics. You would have step length and power of your stride and all of that. And you would have trends, how you are doing in terms of trends, if it's better or higher or lower, I should say. But then is it better or worse? That's the next generation. And it needs to get there before it's truly usable for the general population. And coupled to what you should do about it. So then you have the accuracy, but then the different types of metrics in there, because in the first kind of the second level there, you sell by having more metrics. So this watch is having 10 metrics and this watch is having 15 metrics. So I'm going to buy the 15 one because that's the kind of the selling point, meaning that all of them would generate metrics that are not the measured ones, but inferred metrics or calculated metrics. In some cases, that's what people are asking for. So people are asking for energy expenditure, but that's not something you're actually measuring. It's very tricky to measure, and you would need to be in lab to measure it correctly. So then that metric will be pretty terrible. And people will ask about performance level or something of that, or time to full recovery.
Yeah.
And they have nothing to compare with.
Mm.
So you have an audience with nothing to compare with. So you get away with just throwing something out there. And then you have an additional metric. But now we're entering a space where you need to be accurate enough and it must make sense. So we obviously see a lot of data from different gadgets, and we spend quite a lot of time harmonizing data.
Okay.
So that we could take whatever, and we could say that, well, a sleep metric from this watch is going to be this many percent higher than a sleep metric from this device, so that you can provide any type of data. Or this one is accurate to this level and this one to this level. So we should, if we have data from both, we're going to trust this one.
Okay.
So in that kind of type of analysis, we do check performance metrics as well. And in some cases, because they're not checked really, just thrown out there, we could have good runners, for example, their watch would say that predicted half marathon time was 1 hour 30 minutes, but they did a training session, not even a race, last week, where they did half marathon in 1:20. So they can get away with being, in some cases, flat up stupid.
Okay.
But that's gonna mature, of course. It's gonna be more and more relevant and accurate as the audience becomes more and more informed and educated and asking for the things.
Moving forward with, especially with the growth of AI and technologies such as yours, mm-hmm. I'm really interested in your take on what the role of the professional coach is moving forward, because are we hurtling towards a scenario where the coaches are irrelevant because we've got the data? The data can tell the player, the athlete, what to do when. Is the coach going to be an important part of the setup? Is it an arm around the shoulder? Is it man or athlete management?
Yeah.
How do you see it all fitting together? And I guess, is the role of the coach versus technology collaborative? Is it a combat? Yeah. How's it all going to fit in?
So first of all, we're humans. So human-to-human interaction will be more and more important. And when we work with the numbers could tell you almost all the story, but not all the story.
Okay.
And as I said, if we're not measuring all the things, we're never going to get as accurate as the coach. We can help the coach, augment the coach. I know that our approach is that it's augmenting the coach, a decision aid for the coach.
Okay.
And in some cases, again, back to where you can measure and where you can be accurate or not, you can be accurate in terms of maybe we can calculate what training load would be accurate for you today, or how many minutes of sleep would be the optimal. But then how to do that? Let's say that we say, well, today you should decrease your training load by 5%. And then, okay, 5%, you can take away 5% of the time, or you could drop one interval or skip one drill. If someone is tired, maybe you should take a drill that's their favorite. You should keep the favorite one and take the boring one out, something like that. That is more fine-tuning and nuance, and that is way, way trickier for any AI to do. And in terms of probability and statistics, humans don't behave like they should, right? So we can take something. If you look at World Cup, Soccer World Cup, Football World Cup in November, probability there, I think, had less of 50-something percent accuracy in terms of who made it to the knockout stages.
Right.
So it doesn't really work like that. So you would need the nuance from the coach. We are now working on scaling coaches. So creating AIs that would mimic a specific coach.
Okay.
So you would have two different coaches. As I said, if you're decreasing 5% of the training load, they would maybe take, one coach would say, just go for it anyway. And then we take a rest day tomorrow. And one coach would fine tune and say, let's do one into a less or a bit slower. And coaches are different. But it's a bigger problem that you have fewer coaches that are great. So that's not scalable to the general population. So if you can augment those great coaches to be able to handle more athletes or more people in the general population, that would be better for society, for public health.
But does that path not lead to the complete disappearance of any kind of coach or human element in it, though? Because by definition, the super artificial intelligence is always going to be better than any human, even taking into account the nuance of, say, me watching you perform. I've watched you for 5, 10 years. I know everything about you.
Yeah.
Surely technology is going to be better than a human at doing that in time.
In some parts, but not the emotional, not the
it can't put an arm around the shoulder.
Exactly.
It's maybe the physical side of it, where you've got somebody actually watching you and knowing that your efforts are being analyzed, which might not be the same potentially with technology. I don't know what your thoughts are.
That's interesting. It's been done a little bit of research in that around rehab, and that you could have your AI recommend and kind of adjust your training based on what you do. You can have an chatbot give you prompts on remember to do your training. And it turns out that the most effective scenario is where you have not just the chatbot, because then people know that this is not a real person, but you meet the real person, but that person, the physiotherapist is augmented by the chatbot. Okay. So you know that someone's behind the scenes, and it might be they who wrote the prompt or not, but you don't really know.
Okay.
So that's the most effective. Apart from in psychology, therapy, people tend to be more open when they don't think it's a human on the other side.
Okay.
They're more honest with a chatbot than a human.
Okay.
It's interesting.
That's really interesting. In elite sport and professional sport, compared with the role of the coaches,
mm-hmm.
how do you anticipate the two living in harmony and benefiting each other? Do you have an idea of how that might look to a professional athlete, the role of the coach and the AI working together?
So first of all, the AI can look at so many more things at the same time. Right. So if you have a team sport, if you have basketball, if you have football, soccer, the AI can look at everything at the same time. So you'd have all the players, all the movements, all the types of things that are doing, meaning that you can get the metric from the AI saying the highest probability for you to set the last shot in basketball would be by this player from this position against this defender.
Okay.
Okay. That would be helpful, right?
Yes.
and you would see that already now. One photo was going around on social media lately was Manchester United's analytics bench. But could be any of the teams, right? They would have 8 or so analysts with AI in the stalls looking at the game at the same time. And then you could feed that information to usually the assistant coach.
Okay.
And then you can decide, well, you actually see that the defender on the left side is in the opposing team is slowing down, is getting tired. So we should start. Then the coach would decide what to do with that information, right? The coach would perhaps say, well, in that case, let's go full speed there with our winger for the next 12 minutes. And then we switch our winger to a new one that's going to be completely rested, and therefore we have a higher chance of scoring. So that's one. And the other one area would be to scout and try to find players that mimic the one you just sold. So there are companies out there doing that already now, so that you can feed broadcasting videos from games, and you can have as many players as you want, just computational power.
Okay.
And you can say, this is the profile of the player I'm about to sell. So I want someone with a similar profile, similar speed or endurance and stamina, movement patterns and I don't know, whatever, all the different things. And then I can find, out of all the players in the world, I don't have to send 10 scouts around to go to games, but I can use the entire pool of the world to see which player in Ghana or Serbia will be the most similar, so that I can just put that into the philosophy of the game.
There's going to be Man United fans rubbing their hands going, we've got loads of money, this is going to be great, right? We're going to get back into it.
So yeah, Man United is a special case. It's a brilliant example. They had Mourinho that didn't use any data for 18 months.
Is that right?
Yeah, so they scrapped all the even GPS tracking, nothing for 18 months. So they had a data gap. And now they're back at 8 analysts on the games.
So why was that? Because he believed in himself that he could see better than any...
It was, this must be 2018, 2019, right? Around that time, you had the two swings of the pendulum at the same time. You would have technology that wasn't that good. So you would have people that trusted the technology that they shouldn't have trusted.
Okay.
And then you had the other one saying, well, hang on here. We have five doctors on the team and we have 25 players. You have to talk to five players a day to assess them every single day. You should be able to do that. So let's do, we have the resources to do the manual analysis. And no one really questioned the manual analysis would work. Don't worry about that. Go by feeling.
Right.
And went all in on what you said. If the gadget is telling you that you're feeling poorly, but you're not feeling poorly, should you trust the gadget? That's like in Sweden, the saying is, should you trust the map or the reality?
Okay.
You should trust reality.
Yeah.
And same thing here that, well, if that was the case, there were several clubs, not just them, that did skip technology and went for manual approach and talk into the players and kind of the feeling side of things.
So has that been the big change that up until relatively recently, you've been in one camp or the other?
Yeah,
you've been data or you've been coach-led, whereas now there is that merger.
And now I think it's more of a... Let's call it healthy skepticism.
Okay.
Okay. That all the big clubs, they have literally hundreds of companies pitching to them every year saying, this is the solution. This is going to save you. This is going to be awesome. So they see all those.
And it's fatigue as well. It must be because everyone's promising the essential thing they need.
Yeah. And then obviously the people that are taking care of that, they've seen 50 companies pitching the same thing and they've tried something and then they roll back.
Okay.
And you would also have the clash between science and the practical world. So in science, you need to be deep to be relevant. And in order to be deep, you need to be narrow.
Hmm.
Right? So then you would say, this is the thing that I've researched. This is the thing that would improve you. But then you move it to the practical world, where the coach have to take everything into account.
And it's very wide.
So you might say, well, this was absolutely true. It's scientifically true that you would improve 0.1% with this thing. But if you fail to sleep, you lost 10%. So it kind of washes out. Okay. Don't focus on that one. Focus on something else.
Because you've got the bigger picture is what's most important.
And I think most coaches in many sports have been burnt by that. They jumped on the first couple, maybe, of the scientific breakthroughs that would make them so much better. And then they say, well, that didn't help us. Focused on the wrong things and then spent time on something that wasn't in the big picture.
And you've probably got coaches as well who, if we're talking about soccer, men of a certain age.
Yeah.
Technology is not something they've grown up with. You know, it wasn't done in my day this way. And also, you don't want to promote something that can potentially talk you out of a job. You don't want to big up your replacement.
No,
right?
I think that's been an issue for players as well.
Okay.
So football players sharing their data would be afraid that someone saw that you were injured or you were out of the game. So the kind of the thinking is, I don't want to share that because they're gonna let me go.
Because you're going to be insecure about your own data rather than positive. Okay.
Which is paradoxical because they're already judging you on what's publicly available.
Yeah.
So if you look at, for example, the salaries for football players, it's a very steep increase from 15 to 23 or so. And then from 23 to 35, it's like...
Okay.
So at 35, you're worth less than at 15.
Right.
And you would have players now like Ronaldo and Messi and Ibrahimovic.
Yeah.
They're way past that and they're still performing.
Mm-hmm.
So for them, it would be smart to say, well, actually, I'm not down here. Yeah. I'm up here still. You can see that in my data.
Yeah. Fascinating. I mean, it's going to have such profound implications for professional sport.
Yeah.
when it comes to individual sports,
yeah.
are we not looking at a future where the rich countries, those with enormous resource, are going to dominate the Olympics or any kind of individual sport for that matter, where traditionally we've had athletes from other parts of the world who, without any support, any resource, have got to the top purely through genetics and yeah. talent and hard work alone. Are those days gone where someone can just get to the top and win a gold medal purely because they are the best in the world?
I think those days are gone. I think the other kind of idea would be that you would have more and more countries focusing on sports. So you would have a bigger diversity in the medalists than we've had over the last couple of decades.
Okay.
Big countries that like India and several like them are putting 10-year plans in place, something that wasn't focused on. Sport was not a big thing for, mm-hmm. for the Olympics, for example. Mm-hmm. And you would see already now we have more and more Olympic medalists in from those countries. So it would be kind of both ways here. Okay. You need the support, you need to do a lot of training, you need the technology, you need the help to be successful, but that will be distributed to more and more countries. So it will not be just the US, or you would see a few countries at the top of the podium everywhere, but more and more spread out instead.
I guess there's a big difference between someone like me tracking how well I'm sleeping or what I'm eating, trying to do a fast 5 or 10K.
Yeah.
But you've got a unique perspective in working with elite athletes and professional sports teams, both sides of the pond,
yeah.
where the data is not just a point of interest, it's big business, it's money, right? It can be the difference between success, failure, promotion, relegation. I was hoping you could start just by talking about the difference maybe between the use of this kind of technology in the US versus Europe. Is one territory particularly ahead? Are you seeing signs of encouraging signs of acceptance of this technology? Where are you seeing the most interest for it?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that it's homogenous to begin with. And we can make one differentiation to begin with. You would have the stats, the sports analytics, mm-hmm. where US and baseball, kind of the origin story, or already in the 70s, you'd have baseball stats and calculations of player metrics. And then performance metrics are improving constantly. Mm-hmm. So you would have all big sports in the US, you will have a lot of stats, and you will have a lot of stats on all players, all prospects. The draft, every player will be very well researched.
Yeah.
But that is what you see. So that is, from our perspective, that's only outcome data. Mm-hmm. You would see what happened on the field. But you don't know if I performed poorly or great at the baseball pitch or the basketball court, mm-hmm. if I, because of travel stress or because I didn't sleep or because of mental stress. So for that, you need the data behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, that's the not the sports analytics, but exercise analytics, or keeping in mind all the physiology and psychology as well. And in that area is very, very different, because in some cases, you're not allowed to measure players in the US outside of the field.
Okay.
So the NBA, for example, you can't, or the football league, you're not allowed to tell the players to wear the rings. You will not get the data from the players on that. Whereas that is easier in at least some leagues in Europe, in football and soccer. So then you can leap forward there. And obviously, if you work with individual athletes, you can do that aspect way, way more nuanced. And you could, they also have more ownership of their data. So they might be more interested in using that data, and they would have more personal coaches that could take that.
If you could wave a magic wand, Michael, today and create the tech-driven, data-driven world yeah. that you would love to see, What would it look like? Paint a picture for me in terms of how you would just love to see this technology play out, where you think the real advantages for humanity might be, even maybe how we avoid some of the potential risks, the ethical concerns around data. What does your ideal world look like?
A few things there. First of all, I think that each individual should own their own data, be able to move that around. So you would have all your data about you from young age that you could share with your doctor here, or you move to another country, you bring your data, share it with the other one. For sports teams, that's, to me, feels pretty obvious that you should have your youth data to your junior data and then share it with a new team, and then you move to another, you trade it somewhere.
Does that exist in any sport at the moment of which you're aware?
No. Why do you think that is?
Sorry.
Ownership. The clubs own the data and they own the gadgets in most cases, and you would have competing gadgets measuring the same thing, so it might not be exist where you can transfer it. In NBA, the basketball league, it's actually the players own their data, but it's no practical way of getting it and moving it to the next club, which is interesting.
Yeah.
So from a different perspective. In European football, you would have the problems of the big teams. They might have their players and they have full control, but then they go away on the national team and they lose 10 days of data because they have 10 different national teams that players go to, which is just super strange to me. So that is something that must be in place, and there must be in place that you go from your healthcare provider to the next one, that your data would move with you.
Just quickly on that point, what about the ethical concerns of that data being, yes, owned by me, but potentially accessible to governments, insurance companies, medical professionals? Yeah. There's a whole spider's web of potential problems around that. Yeah. How do we navigate that world?
My way of handling or thinking of that would be that if you own your data, you should be able to give access and also revoke access.
Okay,
that's step one. And also you should be able to monetize your data. There are efforts going in that direction, that if I want to share my data with the insurance company or the pharma company, I should be able to do that, but I should also be paid for it. It shouldn't be the big tech companies that are paid for handing over my data. So I think if we kind of start with a position of it's your data, you can do what you want with it. You can share it with someone, you can take it back. You can share it with someone that can monetize it, but you get a piece of the pie. I think that's the cleanest way of handling it. And then for you to get benefit from it as well. I think it's easier to think of if I have a rare disease and there are five other people with the same rare disease in the world, it would be smart if we pooled our experiences so that someone can work on that and potentially help me. And even if they couldn't help me, help the next one that got the same disease.
Okay.
So I think it's a cleaner way of thinking of it.
Is too much of our data out there already, though, to kind of claw back to this clean vision, which I totally agree with, by the way.
Yeah.
But I'm just conscious of how much the big tech companies, how much information they already have, how much data is out there. Are we past the point of which we can have that kind of clean start, or can that be clawed back, do you think?
I think that the data is scattered now between the different companies.
Mm-hmm.
They have a lot of data, of course. But if you might have your social or your presence on the internet, and maybe some of them would have where you move in terms of your map tracking, some would have where you are shopping.
And
so I think the rules and regulations getting towards that, but it's not going to be easy to get back data that's already out there. Problem for someone else.
but I guess overall you're incredibly optimistic and positive about what this can do. In looking into you're waving that magic wand again.
Yeah.
What else are the benefits for humanity of living in a more data-driven world?
I think the long-term vision might not be that far into the future, is that you should be able to talk to your data. You should be able to have everything pulled together. We need a little bit of development there, in that your psychological profile, your mental state and your stress levels and all of that should be included as well, mm-hmm. which is not something that you see much today. It's possible, and that should be in there as well. So a bit more of how you feel, and there are work now, for example, on how you handle your phone. So digital phenotyping, so that you could see when someone is kind of getting less happy.
Okay.
The pattern of how you use your phone, not what you use, not the what you do, but how often you look at your phone, or if you respond to a text or not, and those types of things can be incorporated as well.
Okay.
So that you can use the technology in the background and metadata from it to figure out how you're feeling, and then be early with the actions.
Because it's preventative, right? If the technology knows you're beginning to feel a little bit down or a little bit anxious, maybe before you do,
yeah.
there's that window of opportunity for some sort of solution or resolution to avoid it accelerating, right?
So pioneer work there is around relapse in addiction behavior. So that if you can have your phone call your sponsor before you know that you needed
it. Of course.
That would be pretty big. But then going back to the idea would be that you could talk to your data and you can get an understanding of where am I today? What should I do? Should I push myself? Are we good to go? Should I be careful with these things or that things, or remember to eat my breakfast today, or whatever it might be.
Okay.
That is my data, my complete picture and what to do with that.
But obviously with training, with performance, with heart rate, with sleep, all mm-hmm. these areas we've talked about, the one we haven't is nutrition. Yeah. And it feels, into my novice opinion, like a much trickier part of the puzzle, mainly because of the number of calories you're eating and how do we measure that, uh-huh. how everyone will differently absorb or use those nutrients.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, you know, obviously there's blood glucose, mm-hmm. the spike we can see from food, but other things, inflammation, leaky gut, all these other things that are going on that maybe aren't as easy to measure as sleep or heart rate. How does nutrition fit into the overall puzzle? And do you feel that is the thing that's maybe dragging development or slowing it down?
You're onto something, because it's cumbersome to measure. If you had to weigh all the ingredients in your food, and that would take too much time, so people wouldn't do it. Even on research side, the research into nutrition is underpowered. Most of the studies in nutrition is like a few tenths of number of people in the studies.
Purely because of the complexity of doing mass trials.
Exactly, it will take too long to get all the details in, and maybe because it's not that much money in it.
Sure, okay.
So no one's paying for a study with 500 people over 2 years.
Okay.
And people wouldn't necessarily comply to it.
Okay.
Okay. So yeah, you have that problem. You have the science not really there. You have kind of a so new era in terms of that. If you have a solid scientific base, the diets, the ideas couldn't move that far away. But now you have everything going all over the place, right? So that's a problem. That's going to be better all the time, hopefully. And then understanding that individualize is helping here as well.
Okay.
So people are starting to realize that, well, actually, with my profile, these are the things that are good for me. Doesn't matter what that celebrity said about his or her diet, but this is what's good for me. And then you need to measure that for the individual. And then we come into the problem of how do we do that in a scalable way? The way we solve it now at Svexa is to measure the outcome and then feed back to the individual, and the individual get to think of that. In some cases, in terms of timing and stuff like that, we can get very accurate.
Okay.
So for example, you can look at the glucose, 24/7 glucose curve that you can measure now, and you can see that you're always low early in the morning, or whatever you're doing, you get a huge spike after lunch. Don't do that anymore. Change something. And also, if you have some, you can get new recommendations in there and say, try this lunch instead, or you need to eat you need to eat more late in the evening so that you avoid the low glucose in the early mornings, and then you would sleep better and therefore you recover better. So that is kind of the not optimal way of doing it, but it's the indirect way of using the output and then feeding back to the individual. So we see this happened, but we don't really know why, because we didn't have your log, but change it or do this instead. And then kind of the intermediate step that you could do with the quantified self movement and people that are interested, you could give them a menu for a week. And then you would see, when we had this menu, these things happened. And then you can kind of create the profile based on the responses to the things that you knew was there. And then you would be able to then highlight, you probably had too much ice cream yesterday because you have the signals since before.
Thank you for listening to the Unfiltered podcast. If you've got this far, I hope you won't mind if I ask you to leave a 5-star review when you get the chance. We'd really appreciate it. And don't forget, you can access all of our exclusive Unfiltered video interviews and features at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. See you next time.